This program is a play on words. It has to do with the sounds men make with their throats and tongues, and with the strange way in which men from different countries make different sounds to express the same meaning.
You see, my wife doesn't understand me.
Damn, feel good.
Du siehst, mein Mann versteht mich einfach nicht.
Tu vois, ma femme ne
comprend pas. Mi esposa no mi comprende.
And so on, for hundreds of different languages, all made up of words. The program also has to do with various little marks on paper, papyrus, tablets of wax, and other materials with various similar marks carved on slabs of stone or in caves or chiseled up outside temples or scrawled up in telephone booths. In fact, as we said, this is a play on words.
Opening announcement.
Words are kept in a storehouse called a dictionary, and when we borrow these words and arrange them in various orders, the result is language.
This word business goes back a long, long way. Back to 1 million BC.
We start at the present day.
Look it, honey. I just got a 48. What say we go and get hitched?
Past the upholstered opulence of the Victorian era.
With your parents' very gracious permission, I have the honor, dear madam, to solicit the rare privilege of your hand in marriage.
Back we go, past the gallant days of the 18th century and the rollicking romanticism of the Elizabethans.
Come live with me, my love, and you shall be my bonny bride.
Past the dumb, tortured days of the Dark Ages we go, and past the glory that was Greece, past the grandeur that was Rome, too, for that matter, and even past the dignified days of ancient Egypt, where men lived this life as if they were already in the next one.
We leave the pharaohs far behind, and also the emperors of China, and pass by the days when Nineveh was young, and Ur of the Chaldees was starting out as a village. And as for Tyre and Sidon and Babylon and Troy, well, they hadn't even been thought of. Back, back we go, across the illimitable arena of eternity, until at last...
1 million BC.
1 million BC. 1 million BC, when man was just an infant and all the world was young. 1 million BC. What does it make you think of?
1 million BC? Why, Victor Mature, of course, and men with long, straight legs and short, curly hair.
Too bad. Go along to a museum sometime and take a look at one of those early men. They had long, straight hair and short, curly legs.
The well-dressed man wore furs on his back and hair on his chest. Instead of joining a club, he carried one. When he wanted to propose to some prehistoric lady, he would take his club in one hand and grab her hair with the other, firmly, of course, but not necessarily gently. Then he would pull, like this. And then, if she needed a little more persuasion, he would just touch her lightly behind the ear with his club, like this.
But prehistoric man was all right. He discovered a lot of things that you and I couldn't do without today.
Like wheels and ships and fire.
And words. Yes, he discovered words. We aren't sure how he did it. Probably not deliberately at all. Probably not like this.
I'm getting fed up with calling this thing long bit wood with one end sharpened sticking into people for the use of. I know what I'll call it. A spear. That's much better. Spear.
No. Far more likely he noticed the noise people made when the wooden things were stuck into them.
Ouch!
Which caused the wooden thing to be called an ouch.
But how did ouch turn into spear? After all, the word is spear nowadays.
That nobody knows. But remember, that was 1 million years ago. You get a lot of people talking about things with their mouths full and lisping and stuttering and so forth for 1 million years, and anything can happen. In any case, whether we like it or not, that's the theory the scientists like.
So that's how it all started.
But let's get down to the words we use today. Let's forget about the other people.
Can't be done. You see, most of the words we use today are stolen, or as the philologists say, borrowed from other people. Take two common enough words, polite and idiot. We all know how they've ended up, but can anybody tell how they started out?
I can tell you.
And who are you, sir?
I am an ancient Greek. Polite and idiot began their careers in ancient Greece. It may surprise you to hear this, but they were in fact political terms. In ancient Greece, it was held to be the clear duty of every citizen to take an active part in politics. Not electioneering or party promotion or vote grubbing, but true politics, the science and art of government. A man who did his duty in this respect was said to be polites, a citizen, while a man who did not do his duty was said to be idiotes.
But how does this bear on their meaning today?
Clearly, on the one hand, a man who does his duty to his fellows is a thoroughly civilized individual, and so polite. Whereas, on the other hand, a person who did not do his duty rapidly came to be regarded as a person who was mentally incapable of doing his duty, and so an idiot.
But how in the world did the political terms of ancient Greece come to be a part of English? How did Greek words get to England?
I expect I brought them with me.
And who are you, sir?
I am a Roman centurion. I sailed with Julius Caesar. We sailed with him to Britain, we Romans, and brought with us the trappings of civilization, roads, law, and language. When we left, hundreds of years later, we left behind us forever our roads that always led to Rome, mother of cities, our law, mother of laws, and our language, Latin, mother of languages. Every language in Europe carries the imprint of Latin. English is solidly founded on our mellifluous Latin tongue. It is our words that the orator uses, and the poet.
Will all great Neptune's ocean wash this blood clean from my hand? No, this my hand will rather the multitudinous seas incarnadine.
There they are. The rolling, majestic syllables of imperial Rome. The poet will translate that last line into Saxon for us, if you please. It shows the contrast.
Will all great Neptune's ocean wash this blood clean from my hand? No, this my hand will rather the multitudinous seas incarnadine, making the green one red.
You see? There it is in Saxon, making the green one red.
Indeed, the Saxon is not half so couth. Remember Alice through the looking glass? Remember what Humpty Dumpty used to say?
Impenetrability, that's what I say.
Yes, indeed. There's a rollicking Roman remark. Let's have that in Saxon, please, Humpty Dumpty.
Ungo throughsomeness. That's what I say.
We certainly owe a lot of music to the Romans. But you were explaining to us just how the English managed to get hold of Greek words.
We brought them with us. Greek has always been the language of culture and philosophy. All cultured Romans spoke Greek, and we left a residue of Greek with our own Latin. Even today, the language of science is still taken from Greek.
Microscope.
telescope.
Seismograph.
Telephone.
Spectrohelioscope.
Psychology.
Electroencephalograph.
Well, we could carry on like this all night, of course, for practically every language under the sun has chipped in its two bits worth to help build up modern English. Once upon a time, we must remember, England was a much invaded little island. Remember that last invasion?
Duke William of Normandy has landed at Hastings!
William the Conqueror, 1066. And with him came his language, the haughty Norman French. You still find it in mottos and in the Houses of Parliament. When a bill is passed by Parliament, the royal assent is given in the words,
Le roi le veut.
Le roi le veut. Norman French, the king wishes it. And in fact, when the king dies, the herald tells the people the news in the age-old language of chivalry, Norman French.
Le roi est mort.
Vive le roi.
The king is dead. Long live the king. But they still say it in Norman French.
And Norman French comes from Latin, and we're already done with Latin.
So much for the history of the words we use.
The use of words. How shall we classify the words we use?
That's an easy one. Every schoolboy knows.
Adjective, sir. Verb, sir. Preposition, sir. Conjunction, sir. Interjection, sir. Nouns and pronouns, sir.
One more. Quickly.
Adverb, sir.
That's it. Well, adjectives. What is an adjective?
An adjective is an attribute added to the name of a thing to describe it more fully.
We know all about adjectives. Commercial announcers can generally be identified by the fact that they talk in nothing but adjectives.
Won't you try this scrumptious, crickly, crackly, crunchy, wunchy, taste-tickling, delicious, palate-inspiring, fresh, delightful, luscious,
that
lovely...
That will be enough, thank you. Adjectives, alas, soon lose their potency. Nowadays, it takes 20 adjectives to do the work of one.
Take the sad story of awful, for instance.
Awful really means inspiring awe. Shakespeare, Milton, and Bunyan found it the best word in their vocabularies to describe the splendor of the heavenly host.
Awful. Once it brought cold shudders to the most depraved and cynical.
So spake the cherub, and his grave rebuke, severe in youthful beauty, added grace invincible. Abashed, the devil stood, and felt how awful goodness is.
The icy breath of eternity used to blow on awful. Now look at it.
I just couldn't get any blue nail polish anywhere. It was awful.
See what we mean? Betsy Coad certainly doesn't mean...
I just couldn't get any blue nail polish anywhere. It inspired me with awe.
So much for adjectives. Next, verbs. What is a verb?
A verb is a word that expresses an action or a state.
Verbs are very common words. No well-regulated sentence should be without one.
Verbs are very moody words. A verb has at least three moods: indicative, imperative, and infinitive. To say nothing of things like subjunctive or optative.
The indicative mood tells us things, as for instance...
Black is black.
True, but trite. However, it is popularly supposed that statistics can prove absolutely anything. So let's get a statistician to tell us something.
Black is white.
That's more like it.
The imperative mood is pretty common, too. Dictatorships, where everything that is not forbidden is compulsory, naturally use the imperative a good deal. So do commercial announcers selling things.
Go now.
Hurry, hurry.
Rush out this very minute.
Drop everything and gallop round to your neighborhood drugstore.
Fling away your crutches and race over to McGinty's extra special annual fire sale.
But whatever it is, do it now. And run. Do not walk.
The infinitive is the language of quotations and generalizations.
To err is human, to forgive divine.
To fill the mouth of deep defiance up.
To be or not to be.
To die. To sleep.
To sleep, perchance to dream.
Tomorrow and tomorrow and tomorrow and tomorrow and...
Yes. So much for the infinitive. Now all verbs have tenses, of course.
Stop.
Why?
That brings us onto dangerous ground.
How so?
That brings up the question of past, present, and future.
Yes, I know, but...
That, sir, is the riddle of the universe. A radio show is no place for the riddles of the universe. The vibrating ether is no place to meddle with eternity.
Why not? It's only the question of time, that's all. It's clear enough.
The question may be clear, but it is monstrously vexed. It relates to the difference between past and present. It invokes monumental subtleties like the cosmic difference between foresight and backsight. It deals with the closed book of the future and the mystical reasons for the closing thereof. It deals with the mysterious reasons underlying...
Tripe.
I beg your pardon?
I said tripe. You want to know what time is? Well, all right. I can tell you in 30 seconds.
You can tell me?
Well, this mathematical physicist here can tell you. Step up to the microphone, Mr. Mathematical Physicist, and tell the people what time is.
Well, it's quite simple, actually. Time can be said to be a sort of fourth dimension.
Oh? Oh. Fourth dimension, eh? Yes. Well, carry on.
What do you mean, carry on? I'm finished. That's all there is to it.
Oh, well, there you are, you see. That's all there is to it. Time may be said to be a sort of fourth dimension.
Quite finished?
Of course.
Then listen to this.
What's that?
Physical mathematicians laughing at your misguided mathematical physicists.
Yes, indeed. We physical mathematicians can show clearly that the peculiar properties of time are inherent in I.
In you?
No, in I. The number I. I, you see, is a square root of minus one.
I see.
I thought you would. It's absurdly simple. The square root of minus one is imaginary, you see.
Naturally. Go on.
How do you mean, go on? I've explained it. That's all.
Oh, well, in that case... No, wait a minute. Oh, the hell with it anyway. What's the next one?
Prepositions. What is a preposition?
A preposition is an indeclinable word governing and normally placed before a noun or pronoun to show its relation to the remainder of the sentence.
You know the sort of thing. Up, down, by, with or from, to or for, over or under.
Does Santa Claus sleep with his whiskers over or under the sheet?
Precisely. You have propounded a very prepositional proposition.
To which we regret to say there is no solution.
Music, quick!
Conjunctions. What is a conjunction?
A conjunction is a word joining words or clauses.
Not very interesting.
Wait a minute. This includes and, but, and if.
Oh, yes.
It is if. Beloved of logicians. Logicians, in fact, talk in nothing but ifs. You will always find an if somewhere in the premises if you're dealing with a logician. Listen to this logician.
If all elephants are addicted to rye whiskey, and if certain empty-handed animals are also insurance salesmen, what, if anything, can be said about those elephants, if any, which are also empty-headed insurance salesmen addicted to rye whiskey?
One thing more. It is also the language of imperialism. If this, if that, if the other, we all recall a well-known imperial bard who wrote a whole poem called...
If.
Interjections. What is an interjection?
An interjection is an exclamation.
Interjections are beloved of lady novelists.
Pshaw!
Psst!
Interjections are also beloved of comic strip writers.
Bim! Wham!
Kaplunk! Wham!
Zowie!
Both these classes use interjections because they let you fill up a lot of space without doing any thinking.
But interjections are also used in everyday life. For instance, when the bishop spills hot tea over his best pants, he uses an interjection.
Dear, dear, dear. My goodness, goodness, gracious me.
Similarly, when a lumberjack cuts himself with an axe, he too uses an interjection.
No, no, don't!
You have just heard a deaf and dumb lumberjack's reaction on cutting himself with an axe. Nouns. What is a noun?
A noun is a word used as the name of a person or thing.
A noun is nothing but a label. Remember that when the epithets are flying, and don't confuse the label with the reality.
Take political abuse, for instance.
Confound you, sir! You're nothing but a confounded red! That's all you are, sir!
That's comic coming from a dyed-in-the-wool reactionary like you.
Run away and hide, you Bolshevik!
Go jump in the lake, you fascist.
How much do those words mean to arguing Canadians? Nothing. They're nothing but the symbols of disagreement.
Mind you, words like red and fascist do have a meaning. They had a lot of meaning to the people who died in revolutions and in ghettos and concentration camps. But in Canada, we must try and remember what they really mean and not just yell them at somebody we don't agree with. We might as well be yelling things like this.
Confound you, sir! You're nothing but a confounded Whig! That's all you are, sir!
That's comic coming from a dyed-in-the-wool Tory like you.
Run away and hide, you radical!
Go jump in the lake, you fundholder.
100 years ago, them was fighting words. See how they sound nowadays. Remember what you'll sound like in 100 years and think before you holler.
Another tricky thing about nouns is the way we can give a delicate flavor to an idea by the right noun. You know...
Our party!
Your faction!
Our leaders!
Your demagogues!
Our information!
Your propaganda!
You see what a very delicate aroma is carried by the right words?
And delicate aromas naturally lead us to deal with proper nouns, the names of persons or places.
As for the names of races, they are improper nouns.
Dago.
Nigger.
Dago.
Jew.
Nigger.
Jew.
Sheenie. Sheenie.
You hear that? That was the hideous pandemonium of racial intolerance. Those are the dragon's teeth that you can sow now if you want to, and which will assuredly rise up as the armed men who will fight the next war, and the next, and the next.
But of course, we do not all take such epithets with equanimity. Some of us protest. A young man getting off a streetcar may protest.
Let me off at this stop, will you?
See that guy? See where he's getting off? Bet you he's another one of them dirty little sheenies.
Sure he is. Only kikes get off around here. Damn kikes. Place is lousy with them.
That dirty swine. Calling me names like that? That dirty swine.
Hello, Joe. Where you been?
I've been waiting for you.
Hello, Pete. Know what happened as I was getting off the streetcar just now?
No. What?
There was a couple of skirts talking. One of them called me a sheeny. The other said, rotten kikes. The place is lousy with them.
Can you beat that?
Yeah. What do they mean by taking me for a sheeny? Me, the corresponding secretary of the Junior Anti-Semitic League.
Pronoun. What is a pronoun?
A pronoun is a word standing for and constructed like a noun.
A word standing for and constructed like a noun.
Then I must be a pronoun, for I stand for and am constructed like a noun. I'm constructed out of the hopes of Plato and the conversation of Socrates, out of the words of Lincoln and the observations of H.G. Wells and G.B. Shaw. I represent many other pronouns, such as you and you. My password is truth, a word which comes hard these days to Teutonic tongues. And the countersign is liberty, a word which is beyond the sons of heaven at the moment. I am constructed out of freedom, and my foundation is built on justice. I contain no artificial preservatives, such as tyranny or dictatorship. I contain no ingredients harmful to others, such as religious or racial discrimination, for I am constructed like the pronoun democracy. I stand for democracy, too, for democracy cannot as yet stand for itself, poor thing. It does not even exist as yet. If you doubt me, look about you, you who are so proud of your democracy. Open your eyes and look about you and blush for shame.
Finally, adverbs. What is an adverb?
An adverb is a word which modifies a verb, an adjective, or another adverb.
Wearily, cheerily, beerily, drearily. That's the sort of thing.
Also, the adverbs of place and time, then and now, here and there.
That brings it all back to me.
What does, madam?
There. You saying there like that. My next-door neighbor gave her boy, you know. He was killed over there. Actually, I feel it's the duty of all mothers to give their boys gladly. That's how my neighbor gave her boy, gladly.
Madam, did she give her boy? Does she say that? Or does she say that he went of his own free will? Madam, this talk of giving what was never yours to give will only obscure the issue. Madam, it will draw down sympathy in quarters where it is not deserved.
You heartless monster! Don't you think our sorrowing mothers who gave their boys so gladly should get any sympathy?
Madam, I give them sympathy for their loss, but I do not believe they want credit for sacrifice. The sacrifice is not theirs, it is the boys'. You merely take glory from your neighbor's son who has sacrificed indeed. You say she gave the boy gladly? I call for adverbs, adverbs to tell us the truth. Tell me how he went to meet the foe.
Unwillingly, unwillingly, unwillingly.
Tell me how he faced the storm of battle.
Fearfully, fearfully, fearfully.
How did the panoply of combat strike him?
Hideously, hideously, hideously.
How did he look when the battle began?
Nervously, nervously, nervously.
How did he speak when the battle began?
Tremblingly, tremblingly, tremblingly.
You're discouraging the war effort. You're making that boy out a coward. How dare you say that boy was a coward?
Tell me. How did he fight?
Bravely.
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 Bravely, for he knew the danger and feared it. Bravely, for he saw his duty and dreaded it. Bravely, for he remembered his home and longed for it. Bravely, for in spite of all this, he saw the enemy and faced him. In the moment of battle, we may be sure that certain incidents which we allowed to happen all over the world during the last 10 years had very little to do with his conscious behavior. He could not put his impressions into words, but to him their meaning was clear. And this clear meaning carried him forward on the word of command to where the bullet stopped him. And that leaves us behind. And what shall we do? Shall we shout meaningless epithets at each other? Shall we make a great to-do about words, taking refuge in the unthinking jargon that says everybody we don't like is a Nazi? Or shall we forget the words for a change and get out and do something about the ugly meaning that lies behind the letters N-A-Z-I? To put it bluntly, shall we go on fooling ourselves forever with empty epithets? Or shall we try looking the truth in the face for a change and live our lives as others have died their deaths, bravely?